You know, it's my great pleasure right now to introduce to everybody a man who really needs no introduction.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King.
Carl. I'm not calling the fans geeks. I'm not calling them rednecks, tobacco chewing nothing, because I've done all that myself.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King. Carl.
In your dreams, you will see me.
Excuse me, please, let's don't talk negatively.
I'm going to win the title. I'm going to keep my money and buy me some good old Tennessee drinking whiskey with it.
Thank you for being such a great husband.
And this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold, baby, just like you and me.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Dragon King Carl Classic Wrestling Audio Show here at WrestlingObserver.com, Figure4Online.com. I'm your host, Carl Stern. Thanks a lot for joining me here. This show is produced and distributed by my website, whenitwascool.com. Hope you will check it out. Every Tuesday, we do a rotation of classic wrestling shows, shows devoted to the history and past of pro wrestling, and I kind of mix them up to keep the show interesting. And so we got a series of shows we do. Last week, you heard the long-form history of wrestling. We're up to the springtime of 1983. And I hope you go back and check out that show if you didn't hear it. That is done in conjunction with the project we're working on over at whenitwascool.com called The Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling Timeline. And I hope you'll take a moment to check that out. There's so many times I go on social media or read an Observer or something. Somebody has some sort of question or comment that is completely, you know, antithetical to what really happened in pro wrestling history. And it's literally being written down over at whenitwascool.com. There's, I mean, it's as simple as a Google search to find out the answer to some of these, quite honestly, asinine questions that come up that I see and think, look, this is a simple thing to know. You know, we're putting it together over there, and I hope you'll check it out, bookmark it, and, you know, let others know about it, distribute it, and most of all, contribute to it. We have a Patreon, and we appreciate everybody being involved in that. That's what keeps our podcasting network going. And today in our rotation of shows, we're going to, this is only the second one of these we've done. That's a magazine review where we're going to go back into wrestling's past, grab a magazine, one of the newsstand magazines, and take a look at it. That was what was, you know, before the internet, before newsletters even. There's wrestling magazines date back, gosh, I guess probably to the 1930s, 1940s for sure. There have been a variety of them. The explosion of the national newsstand magazines really happened in the 1980s as any supermarket or discount store, drugstore, whatever, anywhere you went to, bookstore, any place that sold magazines would oftentimes have upwards to, you know, anywhere between 6 to 12 different magazines on the shelf at the same time dealing solely with wrestling. There was no internet back then. Most people were unaware of the newsletters. Cable television wasn't as prominent as it and satellite TV would become. And so for most people, if they learned about wrestlers in other areas, what wrestling was going on, they did so through the pages of these magazines. Now, the magazines were, by and large, almost entirely kayfabed. They followed the storylines or sometimes made up their own storylines. But in amongst there, you could glean information about interesting wrestlers who may have been in your territory, maybe coming to your territory, things that were happening in other areas. It was really the best and only way to keep up with it. And the photographs taken in these magazines by, you know, famous photographers like Bill Apter and George Napolitano and others, that brought that to life. And you knew who these people were. And it really was the internet before the internet. And these magazines were very important. I don't think they get the credit that they deserve for making, keeping, and developing, you know, millions of fans of wrestling across the country that were, you know, cut off from different territories. Living here where I lived, I didn't have access to the Pacific Northwest. There was no way I could ever see what was happening in Portland or even the AWA for that matter. There were, when they finally got on ESPN, there were places occasionally I could go, you know, to see that, but I couldn't see it regularly. I couldn't see it daily. I had Georgia Championship Wrestling the same way. I, you know, couldn't see Mid-South or World Class until some of those shows got syndicated. So there was a whole world out there of wrestling, even a lot of the WWF stuff until they started becoming syndicated on television, I could not see here. Now, I was a fan of wrestling, Ron Fuller's Southeastern Championship Wrestling, later Continental Wrestling, Memphis Wrestling. I got that show here as well, Jerry Lawler, Jerry Jarrett's promotion. And but beyond that, I knew of wrestling only through the magazines, as did many. And again, when you think about it, you go to the newsstand magazines back in the day, the newsstand, there were hundreds of magazines on the newsstand, ranging everything from, you know, the tabloids to women's magazines to, you know, home craft magazines like Good Housekeeping and stuff like that, news magazines, Time and things of that nature. And there were a lot of magazines for different hobbies, car magazines. A lot of people were big fans of like Hot Rod magazine and stuff like that. There were magazines for gun enthusiasts and motorcycle enthusiasts, and every subgenre you can think of that people had an interest in had multiple magazines devoted to it, just like we have multiple websites devoted today. And pro wrestling certainly had a corner of that market. And one of the most well-known family of magazines, group of magazines, were the Weston magazines, most frequently called the After Mags. And Dave Meltzer kind of coined that phrase back in the day because Bill After was really the face of those magazines. He was the photographer you saw. He was the one that would show up on television shows, handing out awards. They were the really the most widely distributed magazines. And they were a family of magazines. It was Pro Wrestling Illustrated, The Wrestler, Inside Wrestling, and then there were various quarterly and annual specials that came out under different names, some of them very slickly produced, and some of them for, you know, just specific purposes, and but they were all published by, you know, Weston magazines. And so today we're going to look back at one of my favorite magazines, which was Inside Wrestling. At one point in time, I had a subscription. You could get a subscription to any of these magazines individually, or you could get a discounted subscription to, like, the big three from the After Mags, which was Pro Wrestling Illustrated, Inside Wrestling, and The Wrestler. And so I, you know, because I worked a job and earned my own money, I got a subscription to, you could get The Wrestler and Inside Wrestling as a standalone subscription. It wasn't very much. In fact, we may come across an ad in here for it, and we'll know how it was. But on the newsstand, it was $1.75. I mean, it was a little bit more expensive than a comic book at the day, but $1.75 in 1987, that was a pretty good bargain. And so we're going to take a look at Inside Wrestling. I liked Inside Wrestling the best because, you know, I didn't really care for the sensationalized stories that were in there, like the made-up angles and stuff that the magazines ran. I wanted to know facts about the wrestlers I didn't get to see on a regular basis. Inside Wrestling had not only the ratings, which, you know, all we fans of the magazines back in the day loved those ratings, loved to look at them, you know, make up our own, wonder, you know, back. One of the things that really went away in wrestling was the idea of the super match, the dream match. When you had big time, all equal level competing promotions, well, the way like WWF, WWE, and WCW was back in the Monday Night War era, you often thought, hey, what if this wrestler crossed over and faced, like, what would a match between, you know, Steve Austin and Goldberg look like? And what if this wrestler come to my favorite promotion? And when you had the territories, you had all kinds of that. So you could look at these ratings, see who was in different areas. Maybe one of your favorites come up missing from your area. What happened to them? They lost a lose-or-leave-town match or just quit showing up on TV. Where'd they go? Well, through these ratings and stuff, you could find that out. Inside Wrestling published a list of champions every episode in conjunction with their ratings. So you could find who held different belts. And back then, back in the territorial era, championship belts were very important, much more so than they are today. Today, they're viewed as just, you know, props for the story, and it's a much more sports entertainment-oriented production. Back then it was presented more as a actual sport. And so a wrestler would be in your territory, and he would come in, they would say, hey, this is a former United States heavyweight champion. Well, your territory didn't have a United States championship. What are they talking about? What belt is this? Who holds it now? Those questions like that would come up. And inside wrestling, you could keep up with that, even though a promotion might not be in your area. We're going to look at the December 1987 edition of Inside Wrestling. And again, these magazines are cover dated way ahead of time. I've already taken all the information that's relevant in this magazine and incorporated it into the Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling timeline. So if you go to whenitwascool.com, go to the Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling zone, then go to 1987, you'll see anything that was of relevance in this magazine has been incorporated into that timeline. But the information therein is not current to December 1987. They're cover dated way ahead of time. It's really about August of 1980. The summer of 1987 is what the events described herein would be taking place, be relevant for. On the cover, we have and this was a thing that no way you could get away with this in 2022, but back then they often portrayed the cover as gory as possible. They would have somebody bleeding on the cover. Way back in the 70s, and it was way worse. I mean, they used to plaster just blood covered. It looked like a horror magazine or something like that on there as a way to, you know, clickbait, for lack of a better term, before that term even existed, get people to buy that magazine. You could never put the picture of a bloody, bleeding person on the cover of a magazine nowadays, and that'd be socially acceptable. And this is one case. We got a bleeding Dusty Rhodes and a rear chin lock from Lex Luger from one of their matches, obviously during the Four Horsemen reign against Dusty Rhodes there. The cover story says Rhodes challenges Luger. Will Dusty's U.S. title hopes split the superpowers? So what's that all about? Well, we'll find out inside. Then there's an inset photo of Harley Race. Looks like he's kicking Randy Savage. So this is it's obviously like a WWF ring. So it says, warning to Randy Savage, the fans will make you or break you. So this is, again, one of these editorialized, fictionalized stories. So let's get inside this magazine, see what's going on here. And inside contents page was always gave you the different stories and everything. You could find out who the staff people on the staff were, and let's talk about some of them for a minute. The editor-in-chief was Stuart M. Sachs, a real human being. The publisher, managing editor, Craig Peters, another real human being. Senior editor, Bill Apter, which we've already mentioned him. Then there are other associate people in here. Eddie Elner, he's going to be the heel writer for this. There are some made-up characters in this thing, Matt Brock being one of them. He was like this disgruntled old veteran writer, probably written by Bill Apter. Maybe some others wrote him from time to time, but Matt Brock was one of those made-up characters inside this magazine. All right, your cover photos. Luger Rhodes was photoed by Lynn McAllister, so I don't know who that is, and Savage Race was photoed by David Fitzgerald. So if any of you know any of those folks, or you happen to be listening, love to hear from you. Okay, here's the subscription deal. Wrestling's greatest subscription deal, like getting 8 issues for free. So here's where this would be the one I subscribed to. I took part of my job money back when I was in school and subscribed to Inside Wrestler and The Wrestler, Inside Wrestling and The Wrestler. And so they would come, so I'd get 2 magazines a month. And I got both magazines, 24 issues for a year for $27. So $27, that was a little bit of a chunk of change back in 1987. But you got 2 magazines a month. You didn't have to search them out on the newsstand. You got them a little bit ahead of time, like they would usually, you know, beat the newsstand out by a few days. And that was cool to get that right to your mailbox. Sincerely Yours is the letter section. I always presume that these letter sections were about half and half made up and half real. So I don't know. Darren Butland of Burbank, New York, if you're listening to this, please give me a shout out, because you wrote a letter, World Class Defense, and There is a letter in there about, you know, how good world-class wrestling is, and of course droning on about the Von Erichs, and there's a picture of Kevin Von Erich with a chin lock on Brian Adias. At this point in time, I guess I'm either getting or about to be getting world-class. They're going to go into syndication. Part of the letter says, "I disagree with you strongly, Mr. Brands," who I guess it's somebody had written in a letter previously, said Brian Adias would have been given his title shot if he asked Kevin Von Erich for one. As for your claim that World Class is a minor promotion, World Class has had the Von Erichs, the Freebirds, Chris Adams, Hercules Hernandez, Junkyard Dog, Bruiser Brody, King Kong Bundy, Big John Studd, and on. He runs the whole list down, including, and this is what I kind of date it by, Bam Bam Bigelow. So, you know, I saw Bam Bam Bigelow when he first started in Memphis, and I saw him in World Class, so I guess I'm able to get World Class at this point on syndications on a couple different channels here. One of the things about the magazines is because of the way they were printed and formatted, you'd start reading on page 6 and then actually have to jump to like page 48 to finish the article the way it was printed. So the letters continue on page 48. A letter about Adrian Adonis, of all people, Chris J. Kasperk of Hamburg, New York. Maybe this is a real person, I don't know, but he says, recently while browsing through some old issues of Inside Wrestling, I came across a picture of a lean, mean fighting machine named Adrian Adonis. Looking at his picture would give one the impression of a future champion. And, of course, this is the time period where Adrian Adonis is doing the ridiculous, terrible, you know, adorable Adrian gimmick in WWF. He looked absolutely hideous. He had blown up hugely out of shape and looked nothing really like he did early on. Of course, remember, Adrian Adonis is going to get killed in a car wreck the very next year. He's in his, 33 years old, something like that. He's very young. And, you know, Adrian Adonis is one of those people that, man, you see this guy when he's young in the AWA and in the Southwestern wrestling, places like that, and you're like, this guy is great. He's, you know, he's a bigger guy. He's 34 years old, by the way, when he got killed on the 4th of July, 1988, the very next year. So, and he's, you know, he's the first guy I'd really ever see do a dive off the top of a steel cage. It predated Jimmy Snuka and all that, those famous ones. So he's like great, but he just gets so huge and so out of shape and so just unsightly. The gimmick's terrible. And I mean, what if Adrian, and you know, Adrian Adonis has kind of a reputation of not being the easiest guy to get along with. If obviously there's the famous fight between he and Danny Spivey in the dressing room, and you know, you wonder what could have been. He had that great tag team with Jesse Ventura, then later with Dick Murdoch as well. That's, you know, what could have been. It's kind of interesting to think about. I think he's one of those great, you could do a real interesting, like Marvel Comics, what if? You know, what if Adrian Adonis had stayed in shape and stayed alive? What would have become of him? I think it would have been a pretty big star with the right push and whatever. All right, so Top Secret Behind the Dressing Room Door is by David Rosenbaum. He's one of the editors of this magazine, and this is like an editorial, okay? It's like your newspaper editorial where they talk about a subject. He's going to go on about Paul Orndorff here, and again, those type of articles, I almost always skipped over them. I never cared for them. It was just, you know, some writer theorizing, you know, postulating about whoever was newsworthy at the time, and this one is Paul Orndorff. On page 11, we get an ad for Michael Hayes Off the Streets album. Michael Hayes and the Bad Street Band, Off the Streets. So this would be the Bad Street USA song. You could order your copy of it, $9.95 on record or tape. Anybody got that on record or tape? Anybody? Oh, of course, you know, Bad Street USA song was obviously identifiable with the Freebirds and was pretty doggone good little, you know, classic rock song, to be quite honest with you, to have come from, you know, an amateur act or whatever. But, yeah, these – I wonder how many albums that sold. Like, I wonder, you know, did the thing ever go gold? Like, it wasn't through a record company or anything. It was self-published. Michael's single, Bad Street USA, was praised by rock stations like 96 Rock in Atlanta. I bet probably not. But I just wonder. I wonder how many – like, what would a full-page ad in – Inside Wrestling in 1987, what would that even cost? Because it was like in every issue, you had this, you know, Michael Hayes hawking his Bad Street USA record. I just wonder. The next article, we get is On the Road with Craig Peters, one of the longtime personalities there at the After Mags. And it's this is less of an editorial and more of a not a Dave Meltzer type telling of or newsletter telling of stuff, because it's kayfabe, but it's more factual oriented. Like, just for example, just a few paragraphs here. This is a quick quiz. Which tag team combination has held the WWF World Tag Team Belts the longest in the decade of the 1980s? If you answered the British Bulldogs, you're right, but only if you're reading this prior to November 15th, 1987. If it happens to be the 15th or later, the Hart Foundation still have the belts, then Bret the Hitman Hart and Jim the Anvil Neidhart are not only the champions of the are not only the WWF Tag Team Champions, but the champions of with the longest longevity. Now, as we know, Demolition were going to eclipse all that, but we haven't got to that point in history yet. But you get an idea, that's what, you know, this article is about. And these were kind of interesting to me, because they were a little more factual, even though they were kayfabed. Peter's article continues saying, for my money, and I'm writing this in late August, so there's still 3 months to go, I think Hart and Neidhart can do it. In the 1980s, only two teams, as of August, have compiled WWF tag team reigns of 9 months or more, the British Bulldogs and Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis. In the case of the Bulldogs, they held the belts for 9 months and 19 days, having defeated Brutus Beefcake and Greg Valentine on April 7, 1986, and holding the belts until being unseated by the Harts on January 26, 1987. Murdoch and Adonis held the WWF Tag Team belts for 4 days over 9 months, from April 17, 1984 until January 21, 1985. They defeated Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas for the championship, and were downed by Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo. In case you're wondering, Chief J and Jules Strongbow hold the record for the shortest WWF Tag Team title reign of the 1980s, 15 days, stretching from June 28th to July 13th of 1982. Mr. Fuji and Mr. Saito were their opponents as they won and lost the belts. And so that's the type of article we're talking about there. And that stuff is pretty interesting. And again, that sort of stuff we've been talking about recently on the Long Form History of Wrestling podcast. You can check that out. Page 13 is another full-page ad. And again, I wonder, and I used to follow this guy on social media that was involved with this, and I could ask him, and then maybe you're listening, the Filsinger Games. There's always a full-page ad for them. Champions of the Galaxy Wrestling Game. Wrestling's new craze, only $9.95. This game stayed around forever. In fact, I think it's still around. Pretty sure it is. Pretty sure they still put out cards for this thing. Now, I personally have never known another human being that played this. I'm sure these cards are collected. Now they've crossed over into actually doing real people, real historic people, and, you know, the artwork on those cards look great. And I would almost think there would be a collectible community behind these. I mean, I don't, maybe there is, and I just don't hear about it. I know, you know, the old wrestling trading cards you couldn't give those things away. People had piles of them, and now those things are worth lots of money, especially some of those old All-Star cards. I would think some of these Filsinger game cards would be of some value. I don't know. I just wonder what the playing audience size was. If you're listening, did you play these games? Were they pretty cool? Were they pretty fun? They were you know, largely made up, kind of science fiction based, you know, wrestling game. You had here, you had Star Warrior against Wolf. It's pretty interesting. I think it's pretty cool. Filsinger Games out of Lindenhurst, Ohio. That's I always wanted to see one of these. Like, just like I never have in real life. See this. The game equipment. This is what you get. The wrestler description guide. 12 pages of pictures and stories about each wrestler. It includes backgrounds on each Galaxian hero and villain, where they're from, and why they came to fight in the Galaxian Federation. Also, descriptions of each wrestler's favorite moves, such as Star Warrior's Nova Launch and Wolf's Savage Face Claw. You get 24 playing cards. Each card is larger than pictured above. Game charts, which describe what happens when a wrestler is thrown into the turnbuckle or out of the ring. A rule booklet, which includes rules for special matches. And a sample fight card, playing dice, and more. So this is very much like Dungeons and Dragons meets professional wrestling meets what we would later know as like Pokemon or some of those card games like that back in the 80s. So that's cool. I'd love to see one of these in real life. The next couple pages are names making the news, and this is where you get the rundown of the news. Now, one of the things that always aggravated me about this now, back then you just kind of accepted it. It says, okay, well, it's whatever, it's not that important. But nowadays, they never really put dates in this. Like, if I wanted to go put some of this stuff in the Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling timeline, I got to find it from another source because they don't date the stuff, really. But names making the news, let's just take a look at some of this from December 1987, or this will be the summer, August of 87, really. Sir Oliver Humperdinck has taken the WWF by storm since moving over from the Florida area in August. First, Humperdinck claimed Paul Orndorff from manager Bobby Heenan. Y'all remember that? That's one of the things people forget about. Yes, Sir Oliver Humperdinck once managed Paul Orndorff in the WWF briefly, taking him from manager Bobby Heenan. Said, but Humperdinck scored the biggest coup of his career just days later by signing to a contract the much sought after Bam Bam Bigelow. The announcement was made at the August 26th WWF TV tapings in Fresno, so we do get a date there, after it appeared that Slick would be Bigelow's manager. Slick came out for an interview with Nikolai Volkoff, boasting that all the other managers had been eliminated and that the 368-pound tattooed Bigelow would join his crew. Suddenly, Bigelow ran onto the interview set and said to Slick, "How can you say you're my manager when you're not?" Bigelow then introduced Humperdinck and floored Slick. Later in the evening, Bigelow destroyed Volkoff in a challenge match. With Orndorff and Bigelow, Humperdinck has two men in his camp with rule-breaking histories. And although it's impossible to say what direction they'll go in, it's obvious that the House of Humperdinck has quickly become a sturdy force in WWF. Well, not really, as it would turn out. It would be fairly short-lived. And they called, in the magazines, they called heels and faces rule breakers and fan favorites. That was their kayfabed verbiage for heels and baby faces. At press time, we were just days away from a much-anticipated match at the Minneapolis Auditorium pitting the AWA World Tag Team Champions Boris Zukov and Soldat Ustinov against the number one contenders DJ Peterson and Wahoo McDaniel. Yes, I totally forgot that team ever even existed, of DJ Peterson and Wahoo McDaniel. Peterson and McDaniel have already defeated their arch rivals in a double Russian chain match and have scored several non-title victories as well. "There's no stopping us now," said Peterson. "We've beaten them before, and we have no intentions of walking away from this one empty." McDaniel is a former NWA World Tag Team Champion with Jay Youngblood and a former AWA Tag Team Champion with The Crusher. Peterson has never held a major title. And, yeah, it's too bad. DJ Peterson was coming along in this era for a few years here. He would be just kind of on the borderline of breaking through to be something, really, with the AWA. I mean, he teamed also with JT Southern for a while. And he ends up getting killed in his early 30s in a motorcycle accident. And he never really did break through to that next level. Like, he was always just under. He was a guy that had a real good build to him. He was fine in the ring. I think he was real good friends outside the ring with Scott Hall. And but he just never really developed to that next level. The names making the news continues, getting down into my area. Tennessee champion Doug Furniss, truly a mountain of a man, is feuding with Tony Anthony in the Continental area. Down in the Mid-Southern area, yes, the After magazines inexplicably always called the CWA Memphis area the Mid-Southern area. That was never the name of the area. They never called themselves that on TV, never insinuated that was what the area was called. But for some reason, the After mags always called CWA area or Memphis, whatever name they were going under, up until the days of the USWA, and they did start calling them USWA then. They always called them the Mid-Southern area. So down in the Mid-Southern area, the Nasty Boys have turned good and are feuding with AWA Southern Tag Team Champions Pat Tanaka and Paul Diamond. The Hunters currently hold both the WWC and North American Tag Team titles down in Puerto Rico. Briana Diaz has a Japanese man named Ninja Master in his corner. Ninja Master supposedly taught Adias the Oriental tool that he used to injure Kevin Von Erich. Forget who the Ninja Master was, but that Oriental tool move, that was the Terry Gordy previously used that in the area. Oh, here's a name making the news even now. Johnny Ace, yes, John Laurinaitis, flag carrier for the Florida Tag Team Champions, the Sheepherders, was kidnapped. Oh, my gosh. Wonder how that turns out. Blackjack Mulligan and Bugsy McGraw grabbed Ace during a TV interview, tossed him into Mulligan's pickup truck, and drove away. He was brought back to the arena a few nights later, managed to escape, but as he ran away, Kevin Sullivan pulled up in a car, grabbed Ace, and kidnapped him again. Sullivan, Mulligan, and McGraw are demanding $5,000 for the return of Ace, and negotiations are in progress. Johnny Ace would be involved in many negotiations, both licit and illicit, throughout the rest of his career, as we all well know now. Butch Miller and Luke Williams are hoping to get Johnny Ace back by other means, and so far have not called the FBI, although that may not be true now, I don't know, possibly, because Miller and Williams are from New Zealand. How great. They can't. Miller and Williams can't call the FBI because they're dreaded New Zealanders, probably without papers here in the country, with all that illegal immigration we get from New Zealand. Wow, that's a story it just keeps giving there. NWA President Bob Gagel, a 60-year-old veteran of the sport, is back in action again. Apparently, Rip Rogers disagreed with the ruling Gagel made in Kansas City. Oh, the Kansas City area. Rogers and his paid assassin, the Abdullah the Butcher, then attacked Gagel, who was finally aided by Mike George, good old exciting Mr. Excitement, Mr. Electricity, Mr. Charisma, Mike George. Later, George and Gagel signed to wrestle Rogers and Abdullah on August 20th at the Municipal Auditorium in Kansas City. If you're ever in Kansas City, try Gates Barbecue. It's awesome. Awesome. Awesome barbecue. In that match, both teams were disqualified for fighting outside the ring. Quote, I realize that as NWA president, I shouldn't be wrestling. You say, might be a conflict of interest there. But a man's got to do what a man's got to do, said Gagel. I wasn't just going to take what they did lying down. I must protect my authority, says Bob Gagel. Brickhouse Brown is no longer wrestling in the fictional Mid-Southern area. He's in charge of the commission. Yes, the time Brickhouse Brown became a manager. That included Don Bass, Superstar Bubba, yep, Fred, the Shockmaster Ottman, and Iceman Parsons. Brown is a former AWA Southern champion. Earthquake Ferris, one of the most forgettable wrestlers of all time, broke several of Central State champions Rufus R. Jones' ribs. No word on Jones' condition, although you just said he broke several of Rufus's ribs. I would think that would be his condition. Ted DiBiase, outstanding scientific wrestler, now in the WWF. He's using the spinning toe hold as his finishing maneuver. Remember this? There was... It took a second for him to become the Million Dollar Man. Yes, he comes in as the Million Dollar Man and all that, but he's using not the Million Dollar Dream, the Cobra Clutch, essentially, He's using the spinning toe hold as his finishing maneuver. It took him a minute to get everything to come together for old million-dollar man Ted DiBiase. But when I go back, sometimes I remember last year I watched several episodes of like Wrestling Challenge from 1986 and seeing some of the proto-gimmicks of some of these guys that, you know, went on to become very well-known wrestlers in the 1980s was fascinating. Like, you know, names were often changed a little bit or altered. Pretty interesting. The Mighty Yankees are a new masked rule-breaking tag team in the Florida area. I have no memory who these masked anchor. It says nobody knows who they really are, including me. I don't remember who these masked Yankees were. As of September 19th, the UWF's TV show will appear on WPIX-TV, a superstation out of New York City. The tentative air time is noon on Saturdays. World-class referee Rick Hazard has retired from officiating to become a wrestler. I'm going to get revenge on Cowboy Tony. Yes, Tony Falk, who had done the Boy George gimmick of Boy Tony, was now Cowboy Tony out in Texas. It was as stupid as it sounds. Hazard, who suffered a leg injury at the hands of Tony while officiating a match. Believe it or not, Tony was mad because Hazard awarded him the victory in a match against Rick Casey. I wanted to beat the stuffings out of Casey, said Tony, and I wasn't finished yet. The feud between NWA World Champion Ric Flair and top contender Ronnie Garvin is heating up and might culminate with a match at Starrcade 87 on Thanksgiving. Ronnie has gotten the best of Flair, who has been a raving lunatic on TV interviews. Nobody makes a fool out of the Nature Boy without paying the price, and Garvin's got some paying to do, screamed Flair. Him and his brother have me going out of my mind. This ain't going to stop until I finish both of them off. They think they can play games with me, but that's not the way it is. For more details on this incredible feud, check out the January 1988 issue of Pro Wrestling Illustrated on sale shortly. And, of course, we all know how that turns out with Ronnie Garvin actually briefly winning the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. The Insider is by Eddie Ellner, their heel writer, and it's got a disclaimer with it in every issue. The opinions expressed in The Insider are those of Eddie Ellner alone and do not necessarily represent the opinions of anyone else on the staff of this magazine. So, you know, he's going to give his heel commentary. A lot of times it's him, quote, answering, quote, fan letters, whether that's actually real letters or not, who knows. And this one, but it's stuff like this. Like, here's a news item. The giant idiot contest concludes. If there's such a creature on this planet that is more hideous than Andre the Giant, then I am going to commit suicide. Attribute that to pragmatic Eric Bates of Lakewood, California, who is not the winner of the giant idiot contest. To see who is the winner, look below. And he had different people supposedly riding in. We get another full page ad. The videotape event of the year, this is All Japan Women's Wrestling videotapes, the title of one of which is so racially incorrect here in 2022, I can't even tell you what the name of it is. Yes, it is terrible, but wow, such as was the case back in the 80s. On assignment by Liz Hunter, who I think was a fictional character as well. This is one of those traveling, roving reporter kind of deals and really nothing of interest in it. Basically, it's talking about following Ric Flair around and what, you know, kind of a day in the life of Ric Flair sort of deal. This is interesting. I don't really know all the details about it, but the outrageous weekend event for wrestling fans is coming to a city near you. The National Wrestling Convention for Fans. What was the story with this? Did this ever happen? Did anybody ever go to this? The National Wrestling Convention for Fans was going to supposedly be held in New York City, October 10th through 11th, 1987, at the Penta Hotel in Manhattan. In Los Angeles, California, November 14th through 15th, at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. In Washington, D.C., on November 21st and 22nd, at the Stouffer's Concourse Hotel in Arlington, Virginia. And in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, January 16th through 17th, Holiday Inn in Philadelphia. And they're touting that they're going to have special guests at each, and pretty big names. I mean, in New York, Lou Albano, Fred Blassie, David Schultz, the Haiti Kid, Ox Baker, Crazy Luke Baker. I think that's supposed to be Crazy Luke Graham. Ivan Putski, Killer Kowalski, and Lou Thez. In Los Angeles, they say Lou Albano is going to be there. Ivan Putski, Ox Baker, Victor Rivera, Dr. Jerry Graham, and Red Bastine. In Washington, supposedly, we're getting Bruno Sammartino, Killer Kowalski, Baron Mikhail Cicluna, yes, luminary there, the Nighthawk, whoever that is, Tony Atlas, Wendy Richter, and Ox Baker. And then in Philadelphia, it says, and all these say tentative in-person guest, you know, Bruno Sammartino, Larry Sharp, Bulldog Brower, Dominic DiNucci, Killer Kowalski, and more. So I wonder, it says dealers rooms, slideshows, wrestling trivia, costume contest, auctions, films and videos. Did this ever happen? Ticketron. Get your tickets through Ticketron. Kid you not. News from the wrestling capitals is one of these deals where they give you some results. And here's, again, the thing. I have no idea what the date of any of these are, so I couldn't, you know, use these historically for the record or anything. But they got results from Tampa, Florida, Saskatoon, Canada, Syracuse, New York, Baltimore, Maryland, Little Rock, Arkansas, and Tacoma, Washington. So it runs the gambit of mainly WWF and NWA Crockett shows. Let's see. Here's this one is the most interesting looking. Let's see if this is a real deal or not. It looks like an independent show of some sort. Saskatoon, Canada. Peter Ryan is the supposed correspondent. We have Bruiser Brody versus David Schultz. Now, that match has got my attention if that really happened. Bruiser Brody gained an early advantage by kicking Schultz in the face and pummeling him with kicks and punches. Brody caught Schultz with a low blow that sent him down to the mat, then delivered a thunderous leg drop and went for the pin. Schultz kicked out at the two count and took the fight outside the ring, slamming Brody with a chair. Brody used a chair of his own, and both men were counted out. Other bouts were Bill Ash and the Karate Man wrestled to a 15-minute draw. Weird to see Bill Ash that far north. The Mountain Man beat Mike Sundance and Johnny Rods, I guess, in a handicap match. Wendy Richter retained her NWF women's title against Sheena. And DC Drake defeated Kenny Pesario to retain his NWF title. So, real or imagined, that was that show. Matt Brock's Plain Speaking ends up on page 24. And again, Matt Brock is a fictional character, I think written by multiple people, not just Bill Apter. It looks like he's looking back at, he's always pining for the days of old, the days of yorn, kind of like we do here. And he's writing about largely Bruno Sammartino and the World Class area and such. Where are they now? So in the summer of 1987, August-ish of 1987, if you were wondering where Mr. Wrestling 2 is, they say after failing to land any title shots in the Continental area, the popular masked man has decided to wrestle only on a part-time basis while pursuing personal business opportunities in areas outside the mat sport. He has also been asked to coach and advise several wrestlers in the Continental area and is contemplating those offers at this time. Trying to spend more time with my family, Wrestling 2 said from his home in Atlanta. If you ever want to know the real story behind one Johnny Walker, go to whenitwascool.com, go to my Dragon King Carl Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling podcast and listen to the saga, or the true crime story, rather, of Mr. Wrestling 2, Johnny Walker. You'll find that probably pretty interesting. The Destroyer. Yeah, the Destroyer was at the end of his career here. It says the Destroyer, one of wrestling's original masked men, lives comfortably with his family in Syracuse, New York. Although a veteran, Destroyer still wrestles in Japan several times a year. He's a former multi-title holder there and makes goodwill appearances every few months at WWF and NWA shows in upstate New York and Canada. He's currently training several New York State rookies for their pro wrestling debut. Get a capsule profile every issue. They would, look at one particular wrestler. This issue, it was Kurt Hennig, who was still the AWA at this point in time. He's the AWA world champion, as a matter of fact. And you get a pinup of Kurt Hennig and wearing the AWA world title belt. Freebird mugged on Bad Street. Michael Hayes will never take Bubba Rogers lightly again. So this is one of those fabricated articles that, you know, I never was really that interested in these, but you get multiple pages. We get some interesting photos of a match between Michael Hayes and Big Bubba Rogers coming from Bill Watts' UWF area. Then the thing we all look forward to, the magazine readers, we get the ratings and the roll call of champions. All right, so your top 15 was their magazines made up of everybody. This was of all groups, who's the best of all. So this was the one that everybody liked to argue over because it was not just necessarily who was ranked in the NWA, AWA, or WWF, but all of them together. So in the opinion of the After Mags here in August of actually says the ratings are good for August 27th, 1987, and I've put these on the timeline if you want to go look at them. Top 15, Ric Flair, number one. Hulk Hogan, number two. They were always going to rank Hulk Hogan below Ric Flair because the WWF banned them from taking pictures at ringside. They were expanding into more sports entertainment-oriented stuff and away from more sport-oriented stuff. So Hulk Hogan almost always was going to be ranked below whoever the NWA champion was. So Ric Flair, one. Hulk Hogan, two. Lex Luger, number three. Steve Williams, number four. He was, top star there in UWF. Barry Windham, number five. Nikita Koloff, six. AWA World Champion Curt Hennings, number seven. So they weren't feeling any much love for AWA at this point in time. Randy Savage, number eight. Mike Rotundo, number nine. I don't know how Rotundo worked his way up that far as a singles wrestler. Jerry Lawler, number 10. 11, Bruiser Brody. 12, Al Perez. He was the champion, I think, down in world class at this point. 13, Tully Blanchard. 14, Wendell Cooley, yes, from the Continental area. And number 15, Honky Tonk Man. The NWA ratings were not just Crockett or Georgia or whoever, Florida. They were a combination of all these different areas. This was a very fantasy-filled NWA rating. But if you were to rank all the areas together, this is what their opinion was. Number one, the NWA was Ric Flair, who was, of course, the world champion. Two, Lex Luger. Three, Ronnie Garvin. Four, Nikita Koloff. Five, Dusty Rhodes. Six, Tully Blanchard. Seven, Barry Windham. Eight is Mike Rotundo. Nine, Jim Garvin. 10, Kevin Sullivan. 11, Hercules Ayala. I guess he's done in world class. 12, Michael Hayes. 13, Dory Funk Jr. 14, Mike Miller. And 15, Rufus Jones. Interesting that Wendell Cooley cracks the top 15 in the world, but doesn't crack the top 15 in the NWA. AWA has Curt Hennig, the world champion, is number one, followed by Nick Bockwinkel, Greg Gagne, Jerry Lawler, four, and then Larry Zbysko, number five. And I always like these AWA ratings because weird names would pop up. So AWA was running such a small roster, and you wonder, like, what is this? I even saw my old mentor Ken Timms popped up in there before. Well, here you get some weird names you don't associate with AWA. Tommy Rich, of course, he's at number six, and he, wrestled there for a while. Number 11 is Don Bass. Number 15 is George Barnes. Yes, George Barnes from Australia. What? I guess they just want to get George Barnes' name in the magazine. WWF had Hulk Hogan, of course, WWF champions, number one. Honky Tonk Man is Intercontinental Champion, so he's two. Followed up by Randy Savage, One Man Gang, Rick Steamboat, Killer Khan, Harley Race, Hercules Hernandez, Paul Orndorff, and then Bam Bam Bigelow rounds out your top 10. But amazingly enough, in the top 15, they've got number 14, number 15. It's almost like you're back in 1977. You got Superstar Graham at 14 and Bruno Sammartino at 15. Hulk Hogan's your most popular. Ric Flair's your most hated. And then your various people ranked below that. Your tag teams. So your tag teams are interesting. This will be all tag teams in the world all together. The Road Warriors at number one. They almost always rank the Road Warriors number one, as their narrative was the Road Warriors were the greatest tag team ever. They're number two contenders for the NWA World Tag Team titles, mind you. It says in fine print below it, but they rank them as number one. Number two is Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart, who are the WWF Tag Team Champions. Number three, Rock and Roll Express, who are the NWA Tag Team Champions. Number four is the Midnight Express. At this time, that's Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane, who are the U.S. Tag Team Champions. Number five is the Rougeau Brothers. Number six, Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson, who are still in the NWA at this point. Number seven is the British Bulldogs. Number eight are the UWF Tag Team Champions, the Lightning Express of Tim Horner and Brad Armstrong. Number nine are the Florida Tag Team Champions, the Sheep Herders. Yes, your future Bushwhackers. Number 10, Wahoo McDaniel and DJ Peterson. Number 11, Dino Bravo and Greg Valentine. Number 12, Boris Zukov and Soldat Ustinov, who are the AWA World Tag Team Champions. They don't even break the top 10. Number 13 are Eric Embry and Frank Lancaster, who are the World Class Tag Champions. Number 14 is Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden, the Southeastern Continental Tag Champions. That was just called the Continental Tag Champions at the time. They dropped the Southeastern belt name 2 years prior to this. And number 15 was Bruce Hart and Brian Pillman, who are the Calgary International Tag Team Champions. Now then, the roll call of champions, they give you a list of all the different in alphabetical orders. They put a little star out by belts that had changed over the years, or since the last issue, I should say. Of note, the Alabama champions, the Bullet, they even give you the date, like June 22nd, 1987, from Mike Golden in Birmingham. Changed since last issue, we had the All-Japan Asian Tag Team Champions. Takashi Ishikawa and Mighty Inoue had won the belts in a tournament. The AWA International Champion was George Barnes. I guess that's why he's ranked in the AWA. He had won the belt August 25th, 87 from Bill Dundee. The Southern champion was Don Bass. He'd won it from Jerry Lawler in Memphis on August 3rd, 87. The Southern Tag Team Champions were Bad Company, Pat Tanaka and Paul Diamond. They'd beaten Jeff Jarrett and Billy Travis on August 2nd, 87. The British Commonwealth Champion was Gama Singh. He had beaten Owen Hart for the belt August 7th of 87. Central States Tag Team Champions had changed. Brad and Bart Batten had won them in a special stipulation match August 6th of 87. The IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship had changed hands as Kuniyaki Kobayashi had won a tournament over Nobuhiko Takada on August 20th, 87. The NWA TV Championship had changed hands. Nikita Koloff had beat Tully Blanchard August 17th, 87. UWF TV Champion Shane Douglas had beat Eddie Gilbert August 3rd for that belt. The World Class Championship had changed. Al Perez had won a default decision over Kevin Von Erich on August 21st, 87 to win that. And finally, the other belt that had changed hands since the last issue was the WWC World Wrestling Council Tag Team Champions of the Hunters. They had beaten Chris and Mark Youngblood on August 25th, 1987. It says in Trinidad, West Indies. So we presume that's true. Get another fictional story here. Rhodes challenges Luger. Will Dusty's U.S. title hopes split the superpowers? This was your big cover story. The friendship between Nikita Koloff and Dusty Rhodes is on shaky grounds these days. Rhodes' desire to win the U.S. title from Lex Luger plus Nikita's victory over Tully Blanchard for the NWA TV belt might have created an unmendable rift that could split the superpowers forever. Well, didn't happen that way. World-class title mystery Al Perez takes Kevin Von Erich's belt by default. So we get this whole story, I guess, on how that happened. The world-class commissioners claim they ordered Kevin Von Erich to miss his title match against Al Perez. Manager Gary Hart says that Fritz Von Erich was trying to protect his son. What's the real story behind the world-class title mystery? So that's interesting. Hot seat, Magnum TA. He's got an interview with the injured Magnum TA. He says, I'll be back in the ring for Starrcade 1988. Well, unfortunately, sadly, that would not be the case. Magnum would never be able to return to the ring. Warning to Randy Savage, the fans will make or break you. That was another one of our cover feature stories. It's all about the trials and tribulations of being a heel and babyface in WWF. One-on-one, we have a conversation here, an interview, I guess, a fictional interview with Dennis Condrey and Bobby Eaton. Now, remember, they're not the Midnight Express anymore. They have, Dennis Condrey has absconded. And so supposedly they got the two of them together to have this fictional discussion. you know, I don't know what possessed them to do this, but Dennis Condrey supposedly, this was not real, by the way, Dennis Condrey supposedly said, well, here we are, it's been some time, I don't really have anything against you, Bobby, my beef is with Cornette. We were a great team, and there was no reason for Cornette to dump me, so I went back to my roots with Randy. As far as I'm concerned, Cornette's a scum for keeping the Midnight Express name. Yeah, he's Dennis Condrey, I guess he's going back now to teaming with Randy Rose, and they will soon be AWA Tag Team Champions. Bobby Eaton retorts, you know as well as I do, Dennis, that I've got nothing to say about that. I just go out there and do my job, and whatever my team is called doesn't matter to me. You got to understand, though, that the name the Midnight Express is known throughout the world, and Jimmy just wasn't going to give up a good thing. Besides, I don't really see why he should have. And so I guess they're going to bicker back and forth. So, whatever. All right, let's see. The rest of it, most of the rest of the magazine then is filled out by the conclusion of the articles that were begun pages earlier. As we go to the back here, so we got anything else new or of interest. This month in the Wrestler magazine, I'll be waiting for it to come in my mailbox, says, will Hulk Hogan be drowned by a new wave of challengers that include Rick Rude, Bam Bam Bigelow, One Man Gang, and Ted DiBiase? A Wrestler exclusive, the man Barry Windham fears the most. Plus, the battle was in Jerry Lawler's court, but Kurt Hennig still wears the AWA crown. Ric Flair must wrestle Steve Williams now. Brutus Beefcake cuts down Johnny V's crew. Q&A interview with Ronnie Garvin. Introducing Sean Simpson. And in the pages of Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine, Ric Flair, the Garvins are driving me crazy. Jealousy in the WWF. Find out why everyone is out to get Ted DiBiase. Plus, a giant full-color centerfold, plus the career bio of the Road Warriors. Is Hulk Hogan jealous of Jesse Ventura's Hollywood success? And it's time to cast your vote for the best of 1987 in our special Achievement 87 fan poll and a special press conference with Larry Zbyszko, the PWI poll, and scouting reports. So that's what you would be getting in the other After Newsstand magazines at on sale at the time here. And then on the back cover, you can get your merch, your official Pro Wrestling Illustrated merch. Now, I need me a new Pro Wrestling Illustrated t-shirt. It was red shirt with the Pro Wrestling Illustrated logo stamped on it. You can get bumper stickers, a trucker cap, a button, a frisbee, or the deluxe package that had all of it in there for just $20. Look, that t-shirt was $7. I would absolutely love to have one of those now. So that is your Inside Wrestling Magazine, cover dated December 1987 for events happening in the summer of 1987. Hope you enjoyed this show. Next go around, our rotation show, when you hear me next week, we'll be talking from the pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, where we'll take a look at a biography or an obituary as written by Dave Meltzer in the pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Then after that, we'll be back to the GKT, the Greatest Kayfabe Tournament, where you will be voting. Now, you need to follow us on Twitter. Go to whenitwascool.com. Follow our new Twitter account. Our old Twitter account does not exist anymore. You need to go follow our new one so you can vote on who wins in a match between Hiroshi Tanahashi and Nature Boy Buddy Rogers. And that will be coming up soon. And then we will be around to the History of Pro Wrestling at Madison Square Garden, which is getting very, very interesting as we've moved into the second garden now. So all that and much, much more here. Go support us at whenitwascool.com. Look forward to seeing you. Please, we need you as a Patreon over there. I've got 2,000 shows in our archive you can listen to on not just pro wrestling history, though there's plenty of that, obviously, but retro pop culture as well. We do a lot and lots of very fun, interesting stuff there. Check us out. WhenItWasCool.com. Look forward to seeing you there soon.
Excuse me, please. Let's don't talk negatively. Speaking of winners, surprise, surprise, WhenItWasCool.com is your home for retro pop culture articles and podcasts. To all our patron supporters, this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold just like you and me. Family friendly and fun. WhenItWasCool.com.